Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 8, Episode 5. It's the spoiler edition, which means we are going to talk about everything. Books included, prophecies included. Aaron, this is the last opportunity we're going to have to actually guess about the finale, like, or talk about what we want to see out of the finale before we actually see it.
Yeah.
So I did want to take some time today, and I feel like this would have been better suited for our ultra mega 2.5 hour podcast on Tuesday.
Yeah.
But this is the last opportunity, so I definitely want to take it to just talk about what we hope to see out of the finale. Not what we need to see, not, oh, if they don't do this, it's going to suck. Just, like, what's your feeling going into the finale about it?
Well, it's such a broad question because, like, in terms of hashtag fan bankruptcy, this is very dangerous behavior to engage in, Jim.
I've got a loan waiting for you. Just right here.
I mean,
there's money on tap.
29.9% annual percentage rate.
Well, that's only if you default on it.
That's only, only if I default. I think there's a lot of things I'd like to see. I don't know if there's anything must-haves right now. There's a couple things that I think would probably make things a little better in retrospect. One of the big ones is I would like for Bran to do something. That would directly use his three-eyed raven powers for something other than just destabilizing the realm and the geopolitical situation he finds himself into.
Uh-huh.
Something that maybe you would even, like, go back and think about what he did during the Battle of Winterfell and the Long Night and think, oh, that's what he was doing. I would like to see him do something, like, with the analyzing the history of the Westeros to come up with a way forward for the realm, or maybe, you know, there's going to be some dragon taming that has to be on, and, like, people have been long predicting that one of the most epic ways for the three-eyed raven's prophecy about Bran that he'll never walk but he will fly would be to take to the wings in a dragon, get behind the wheel of a brand new 2019 Drogon. I guess things like that, I would like that would be something interesting. I think that, like, checking back in with Brienne to see, because the last time we saw her, she's just on her knees weeping, like, just utterly bereft, and, like, that's not how I want to leave one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, I think for me that's the major thing they need to do, is give these characters some kind of satisfying ending. Just, like, some closure. If you know, at least for some of the characters that I like, I'm gonna say it's become more difficult to do that, I think, after this last episode, but not impossible. Some of these characters that I've come to know and love over the course of these 10 years now, I really just want to see some kind of finality to their stories. Something that tells me that they are, you know, they appreciate where they've been, how far they've come, and they're different people now. I mean, that's the story of time,
right?
Is people change. At least I think so. So I just want to see the characters serviced a little bit more.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see, because it seems like it's pretty obvious that there's going to be something that goes down between Danny and John. I presume John is probably going to be victorious, unless, you know, Martin and the Double D's are going for just maximum emotional devastation and bummed outness.
You know, bittersweet.
But like, I'd also like to see, because, you know, we talked about how, a few episodes ago when John and Sam said goodbye, that it felt like that might be the final goodbye, that we're never going to see Sam. But I think now that John's been sufficiently traumatized, that maybe it would be nice to see John be able to hand off the reins of power or something to, like, a guy like Sam. I would like to, you know, like, I don't know how much time we're going to have this, but, like, I think if there's any hope for bittersweet resolution of this, that we also have to know that our kind of favorite characters are okay. Like, or not the favorite characters, the realm itself. Like, what is the continuity? Who is going to be on the Iron Throne? What power structure is going to survive? Like, is you know, is Varys' hope for the realm being secure actually going to come to fruition? I don't know how they hint that in the hour that they've got, and also wrap up the Dany storyline and all.
Yeah.
But, like, that's something I would like to see. I'd like to see, you know, and so that would get Sans involved. I guess the other thing, the other real big one that I feel strongly about is they have to have something to put the period at the end of Arya's plotline.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she was on an arc of this kind of like dark vengeance path, and they curved her off of that arc back to where she now has a hope of normalcy. But I think I've been thinking about it a lot, her running back to Gendry, and, you know, we joked about, oh, I'm ready to be your lady now. Like, that would feel false.
It would.
So what does a Arya unburdened with the weight of avenging her family, but also not a conventional lady in this world that doesn't exactly reward unconventional ladies, what does that actually look like? It would be nice to see a hint of that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't feel like I have a good answer. If you asked me to write a conclusion to Arya's story, I don't think I could do it.
The Iron Islands turns out to be a dormant volcano chain that just explodes and wipes it off the map. There are no Iron Islands anymore.
But Yara gets out.
Nope.
Yara goes to Dorne.
Nope.
She becomes the new Princess of Dorne.
20 years out from the Iron Island, they're like the Jedi in A New Hope. Or it's like vaguely, Iron Islands? Who? What? That's ancient. Ancient islands and hokey plot devices.
Here comes Yara with a lightsaber.
Westeros just can't risk another Euron. I mean, we just make sure that doesn't happen. We need the old Valyria, the motherfuckers. It's going to be old iron islands, and it's just going to be a smoking pit in the middle of the Sunset Sea. I don't know how modest those hopes are, because I think, you know, capping off a character as big as Arya is and also all the things they built with towards Bran and his gifts, like, I feel like those are pretty modest goals, but I'm also worried that I'm setting myself up for failure too.
Yeah, I mean, you still have a lot of characters that people care about. I mean, Davos, I don't know that Davos has much more story in this story, but the big one, I think, as a standout is probably Sansa, because you can't just leave Sansa as an adversary of Dany and just end her story that way. Mm-hmm. You need something for Sansa, whether she continues to be the Lady of Winterfell in this new set of kingdoms, whatever that looks like, or whether she, you know, actually sits on the throne, perhaps, in some weird twist of lineage. Maybe she's also a Targaryen somehow. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But I think they need to do a little bit more with Sansa.
Right. Okay. What else?
I don't know. I think we should probably get to our spoiler section of the podcast, because that's what everyone's here for.
Okay. I will say that for next week, I'm working on an outline with my co-author of Gods of Thrones, Anthony, where we're going to look, kind of do a deep dive on, going on the assumption that most of these plot points, like Dany turning evil, and even maybe Jaime with Cersei, that these beats are going to pretty much happen in the book. Obviously, the toughest one's going to be the Night King, because there's not even a Night King in the books, or at least thus far. But like, if we grant that this is kind of more or less the shape that George Martin intended, and then we're going to go and rewind it to where we are at in the books, because we've long talked about how the show has pared down a lot of the plots that are going on in the books to kind of bring this to conclusion. You know, I was surprised when the Iron Islanders came back, because it seemed like that was one of the plots that they were kind of like cauterizing. Mm-hmm. The reason Dorne collapsed like a souffle is because the Double D's decided not to have that second stage ignition where the Dorne, you know, the Dornish leaders unveiled their plot that they had to try to take back the Iron Throne with the Targaryens. There's a lot of other the young Griff, this pretender, false Targaryen that Varys and Illyrio were trying to put on the throne. There's a lot of been a lot of people talking about these theories and how they look like if you map them on to what the show has done and how they kind of made a lot more sense. And we're going to kind of delve into that. I want to kind of get people's appetite warmed up for it by reading Ellis's D's feedback. And of course, you can send feedback into GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. They start, one theory I've seen pop up a few times is that the show is suffering due to the omission of the young Griff / fake Aegon storylines from the show. First off, apologies to Jim, since this stuff is very book-heavy theorizing, but I'd like to know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I'm roughly familiar with it, but
The crux of this criticism is that large parts of Westeros have been made redundant, such as Dorne. This has always been the case with the show. The Reach, the Stormlands, and only the North and King's Landing ever being relevant. Secondly, there's an argument that several characters' arcs and motivations have become weakened and diffuse as a result of these omissions, such as Varys, Tyrion, and Euron. These factors are said to contribute to the poor execution of the end of the show, since Daenerys' clear military advantage over Cersei had to be artificially reduced to level the playing field by making her advisors suddenly stupid, such as Tyrion, the Long Night plot only serving the Halver forces, and the capture of three characters, such as Yara, Ilaria, and her daughter, resulting in her losing a large chunk of her Westerosi allies. These theories claim that Daenerys won't have these advantages when she finally crosses over in the books, since young Griff already has the support of Dorne and Varys, who has been trying to put him on the throne since King's Landing fell to the Lannisters and Bobby B, and after taking over the Stormlands, will likely be set to oust Tommen from King's Landing. Again, not my theory, just what Reddit's saying. So it'll be Targ versus Targ versus Targ, Dany, fake Aegon, and Jon Snow slash Aegon showdown in the end. While this theory holds some water, I think it's somewhat unfair criticism to the Double Ds for having omitted it. The entire young Griff storyline is still in its infancy in the books, and we're only introduced to him in Dance. There's still a lot of fleshing out to be done. No, I want to say that, like, if when Anthony and I explore this, this isn't going to be a takedown of the Double Ds, because I think when you're adapting the books and you're still thinking that you're going to get at least the Winds of Winter, so you get a better idea what George is looking at. And if you look at his end game, where, you know, here's the person that's going to, here are the battles that take place, and here's who's going to live and who's going to die, it'd be very easy in season 4 or 5 to be like, okay, well, we can just trim this plot and we can trim this plot, it doesn't matter. But then when you have to do the thing that Martin himself is having to do, where it's like, oh shit, we've got all these different pieces, how do we get them to where they need to be, that's when some of these weaknesses expose themselves. So it's like, yeah, maybe if the Double Ds could go back to season 5 and lay some of these, they would have, but they couldn't, and I'm not sure if it's a bad decision from when they made it.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're going to be the kind of like have like a 20-30 minute conversation for the spoiler edition next week. And of course, we'll also be able to roll in anything that's come out in this weekend's episode. Cause there's a possibility that I don't think that if you're like dead set into thinking that, you know, there was no straw that broke the dragon's back, that it's going to make everything all right. Mm-hmm. And if you're just fundamentally unsatisfied with the death of Rhaegar and how the Battle of Winterfell, I don't think it'll be enough to salvage it. But if you're kind of like in that roughly 1/3 of fandom that's kind of like, well, yeah, I'm disappointed, but I'm also not just like just fucking having a conniption fit over it. Maybe it could win over some centrist independence in the Game of Thrones election.
probably so. I mean, I you know, was not one who had declared fan bankruptcy after that Winterfell episode and after the episode.
How's
after
your
it.
Fan portfolio looking now, Jim?
I've liquidated it all. It has not been enough to cover my debts, and therefore fan bankruptcy. I'm hoping that we can go into the next episode and just get some good character moments, some closure on all this stuff, and I'm looking forward to being a bankrupt fan next episode.
He's got not but pocket lint and his last free burrito gift card from Chipotle.
Right.
But he's hanging on that card. Okay, so we got a lot of, I thought it's appropriate because, you know, it's tough. It's a spoiler podcast. We've always tried to look at the books, look at the show through the prism of the books. And one of the things that I found especially shocking is one of the kind of bedrock things I've always felt is that even if the show doesn't deal with the prophecy like the Valonqar, that gives us a hint to how, I've said it many times, I'll be shocked if you don't look back and think, oh, okay, even though the show didn't go into the Valonqar prophecy, I can totally see how that would fit in. I don't know that Jaime and Cersei dying together being killed and crushed by King's Landing fits that. It doesn't exactly not fit it, but I feel like that this isn't the episode to start like sifting through the tea leaves and trying to figure it out. So this is going to be more of disappointed book fans trying to come to grips with what we saw in this last episode, as well as people who are trying to square the circle and say, actually, if you think about it. So if that sounds good, let's get into it. Before we get further into the podcast, I want to talk about what's going on here at baldmove.com. I'm not sure if you're aware, but there's another fantastic series on HBO right now, Chernobyl. which is a different sort of disaster from what we see for the destruction of King's Landing. This is a very much a 20th century type of disaster involving a nuclear reactor exploding in Russia back in the 80s. And it's really good. It's got a great cast. It seems like it's got a lot of accuracy and drama to it. And we're having a great time covering it. As much as you can in a disaster like this, where people's faces are literally melting off, over on our TV podcast feed, you can find that by searching for Bald Move TV in your favorite podcast app. And also this Friday, we're going to be talking about some other great television, such as Catch 22, the new series on Hulu, Fleabag, returning to Amazon, and also we'll be talking about our thoughts on the Muhammad Ali What's My Name documentary, also debuting this week on HBO. We will early next week have full coverage of John Wick 3 Parabellum in the Bald Movies feed. That's also where you can find our Super Serious Film Fest. We just released Excalibur. We have one more film in that series, the Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy. Please subscribe to the movies feed, search for Bald Movies in your favorite podcast aggregator to find that, and subscribe so you can get all that great information. We'll also, immediately after the live recording of our podcast on Tuesday, we're going to go on twitch.tv/baldmove, me and Jim. We're going to be playing a browser-based Game of Thrones game called Winter is Coming. It's not a sponsorship or anything. We're just kind of wanting to kick the tires and check it out. And we're also going to be broadcasting our old gameplay footage of us playing through the old Forrester campaign of the Telltale Game of Thrones game as well. And if you're not familiar with us playing those style of games, we try to make all the bad choices. Most people try to do the right thing by their character. We always are looking to subvert your expectations, and a good time is had by everyone except for House Forrester. Finally, we have a bunch of merch. Merch.baldmove.com is where you can find some great t-shirt designs involving Bald Move and Game of Thrones. My book that I wrote, Gods of Thrones, is still selling at godsofthrones.com, and it continues to be 25% off. We also have the Starewood pin design still available in limited quantities at pin-y.com. And as far as the merch site, still not too late to declare hashtag fan bankruptcy. We have a t-shirt for the fans have lost everything but the shirt on their back. Even if you got no shirt on your back, we got a shirt for you, merch.baldmove.com. And that's what's going on here at baldmove.com. Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here's a scenario for you. It's late on Sunday, you've watched the final episode of Game of Thrones, and you've got to, need to, talk about it with your friends. But how many of you have a ready-made set of buddies that are as knowledgeable and passionate about Thrones as you?
That's where we come in. After the final episode airs this Sunday, we'll take to the microphones to discuss the end, which becomes our instant take. But did you know, we also record an extended version live, which features a discussion of the episode with the Bald Move community. The catch is, you have to be a club member to watch, listen, and participate.
But it's easy to sign up. Just go to club.baldmove.com where you can see all the premium features, club memberships, grants, and you can start a free 30-day trial. Join in on the After Thrones conversation at club.baldmove.com. Again, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com is how you send in feedback. Anna M., I'm curious if you guys will cover the next books if and when they ever come out. I know it may be unlikely, but if they do get released, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. Anna, I think it's almost a lock since we are definitely going to be covering the prequel series and any of the other spinoffs of Game of Thrones for as long as they continue to be interesting creatively, you mm-hmm. know, and entertaining to us. That if Winds of Winter comes out and is released, it'll be a day one read for me. Like I literally stay up as late as necessary to read because like I gotta know I like now more than ever I gotta know how much this can George do a better job, can he garden his way out of this, like I'm literally like this is one of the more interesting things in entertainment out there, so yeah, definitely. I don't know what your interest would be in just kind of like talking through that stuff with me or
I don't know, I've never read any of the books, right. I feel like I would just be so lost jumping into this story at the point that it's at.
Maybe.
I don't know if I could get up to speed in time to, you know, day two do a podcast.
I think almost this would just drive fucking book fans crazy, but I think you could skip the first three. I think you could skip Game of Thrones.
Because they're very similar to the show.
Clash of Kings and Storm of Swords. Just because, they're very, very faithful. But yeah, the big difference are happening in Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons. So you read those two.
Are they the worst books? Like, you're telling me skip the good ones, read the bad ones.
But you know, you got all the good stuff to be in. And they're not bad. They're not three are just very tight.
Yeah.
And everything you kind of see, everything's like after Game of Thrones, everything's ahead of steam that's building the things. And whereas Feast and Dance just kind of like spread out and kind of take their time to set up the geopolitical. I mean, imagine like the whole problem with these books, if I can be so bold, and I'm not the first one to say this, but George Martin intended to have a 5-year time jump. How these Stark children were going to, you know, as young cadets go out into the world and be brutally fucked and get thrown to the mercy of their enemies, and then flash forward 5 years to see how they then you play their individual parts to get vengeance and to restore justice in the kingdom. And as he started doing that, his gardener tendency just realized, you know, some of these guys are really well suited to do that, and others are just like, there's no way. Like, you can't take Arya as a little girl getting on the boat to Braavos, and 5 years later she comes back and can switch faces and stuff. He's like, oh, I gotta actually tell a story. I gotta tell the story of how Dany learns to be a queen. I gotta do all that stuff. And it's almost like, imagine if before Game of Thrones he had to tell the roughly 20-year piece of like the Robert's Rebellion and all the little petty jealousies and strifes and intricate planning to Illyrio and he just jumped right into the most interesting part of the story where all that shit was falling apart. Well, now Feast and Dance is all about the, like, War of the Five Kings is over and the shits are in control of King's Landing and Dany is kind of whooped Slaver's Bay. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. And It's interesting
in a different way.
It's interesting in a different way, but it's not the pulse pounding. Oh my God! Not that, but and there are those moments that George puts in there, but they're nothing like the Red Wedding. There's nothing like the beheading of Ned, stuff like that. So,
I saw that was it Barristan Selmy, the guy who plays him, mm-hmm. was out there saying, "Oh yeah, George has got the books written. He's actually got both of them written. They're gonna come out 2 months after the." Series ends. I've got a vicious, completely untrue rumor to spread about the books. George actually was offered a 2-book deal. He said, "Nah, I'll do it in one."
Yeah,
yeah. That's the rumor I'm starting.
Did you see that George came out pretty hard against this rumor?
But, oh yeah, I did.
But he would if there's a top secret publisher deal that had an ironclad NDA, then you'd expect him to do that. But Ian's out there going crazy. But the good news is, just to get to your question, Anna, is I think that regardless of whether Jim is going to be up for that or not, I've got a lot of like friends in mm-hmm. podcasting and like Anthony that would be happy to come in. I even kind of want to come back for Fire and Blood, to be honest.
Oh yeah,
and that comes out I think later on this year.
I thought that came out last.
Since the first volume.
Oh, there are two volumes.
It's 300 years of Targaryen history. We're only through the first 150, Jim.
The Double D's could have done it in one volume.
They only need 6 chapters.
No.
The publisher offers him 10, but they take 6. Okay, I think we've answered that thoroughly. James H., in this latest episode, The Bells, we finally get an answer to the question, what is Martin playing at? And how? The story of Fire and Ice will go down as the building up of a fanatical tyrant, with loyal followers willing to do anything for her, whose entitlement and lust for power corrupted her, and presumably her downfall at the hand of the prince that was promised. Which is a valid and even commendable story to tell. And in retrospect, I kind of think it's genius. The true threat was never the White Walkers, it was the humans, and it was right in front of us the whole time, but not the human we thought was the problem all along. I will say that, like, one thing I didn't mention in the our predictions, or I guess our hopes and fears type of segment, is it would be nice if they found a way to make the prince that was promised a little bit more of a thing. As mm-hmm. much time as they've spent kind of promoting that theory in connection with the White Walkers explicitly, the fact that Arya is the one that killed them. So it'd be nice for them to come up with a clever way to retrofit that prophecy into, well, actually, the Lord of Light is keeping Jon around because he knows that this imbalanced situation caused Dany to go mad and that he was going to be a check. It'd be nice for them to acknowledge that is like a greater fulfillment of that. I don't know how they would do that. And
yeah, it's so much harder to do it now than it would have been, two episodes ago.
Yeah. But that's the other thing, is like, that's why it's like, it's really tough to peg this, because this show, unlike so many others, like this show could be redeemed through George really nailing the books. Because if we look back and see like, oh, well, the show is kind of a Cliff Notes rushed version of that. But like, some of these moments that didn't quite work in the show would work if you actually knew the things that the characters are quote unquote supposed to have said or supposed to have done. Kind of like the way the old David Lynch, I think, Dune movie works. If you're familiar with the Dune universe, is like, okay, this doesn't tell the story very well, but it does a great job of visually telling things like the Clegane Bowl, the destruction of King's Landing, and mm-hmm. The Battle of Winterfell. Like, I could see it being redeemed. And also, man, like, I'm impressed with just not even a week out how many people have gone through and started to do the connective things and show all the foreshadowing that went into Dany being the Mad Queen. I don't think it fully redeems how they did the plot, but nope. like, this is just what people have had to do in a week. And what happens when new books come out? What happens when Fire and Blood comes out? If there's another fucking Dunkin' Egg novel that... This show's got legs in a way that most shows when they end don't. Like Breaking Bad, you've got Better Call Saul, but you know, like Lost, there's not going to be any more Lost lore that comes out that could potentially give that extra meaning if you weren't if you're unhappy with it, you know?
Yeah.
Moving on with James, the true travesty here is the narrative execution, of course. These last two seasons have been forced through at breakneck pace, and have been failing the execution, and it's been a huge disservice to the previous six seasons of television, some of the best ever made. For those hoping Martin's books will play out differently, I think they'll be in for a rude awakening. I think the Double D's have faithfully laid out Martin's bullet points. They just struggled to connect the dots.
That's fine. I don't think the bullet points are bad, right?
Like, no.
The bullet points could be amazing. It's just those dots need to be connected.
I mean, because I said that I didn't see a lot of people saying that they were just unhappy with Danny turning evil. That's not true. There's obviously a lot of people out there saying that, but there's like...
Sure.
There's smart takes
us.
On both sides, and there's dumb takes on both sides. Mm-hmm. Like, the people are just like, there's, you know, mad that Danny turned evil. That's not... I don't think that, you know, it's fine to be disappointed, but like, it's a narratively valid choice, and there's certainly tracks that were laid in that direction. You just didn't like it. And then I think the dumb take on the other side is like, there's zero problems with execution and they did it and you guys are just pissed off and mad. And oh, by the way, no one's ever happy with the way anything ends. Cough, cough, Avengers Endgame, cough, cough, Breaking Bad, cough, cough, The Leftovers. Like,
uh-huh.
Yeah, there's dumb, there's, you know, the human condition is a fucking bell curve and you got goofballs on all sides of it. So, Shaban says, I read the 20,000 or 200,000 fans signing petition for season 8 remakes and
oh,
I have a plan.
God.
Have you seen this?
Yo, have I ever? Yeah.
I
did you
think...
sign it? Did you sign it, Aaron?
No, fuck no.
Okay, good.
Because these petitions are dumb. I think... It would be damn interesting to see someone 20 years from now essentially do that. Like, we are going to take as canon up through season 6, and then we're going to reimagine season 7 and 8. Kind of like the way they did. There's precedent, because we mm-hmm. there is one thing that I can think of that's had the similar thing, which is Full Metal Alchemist, anime mm-hmm. series.
Yeah.
The anime show started off really, really strong, and everybody liked it, and then it caught ahead of its manga roots, and it finished ahead of that, and everybody kind of hated it. And then they came out a few years later once the manga was finished and did the Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, I think, where they did it the way, and that was a lot more highly regarded. Like, I think there's room for, especially if the books come out and HBO still has the properties, like, why not do, I don't know what you would call it, Game of Thrones Remastered or Game of Thrones The Maester's Take, or, but yeah, like, you'd have to recast everybody, but like, end it with Dany and our fleet heading to Westeros, because I think most people were, the vast majority of fans were happy with Game of Thrones 100% up until then, and this redo books or season 7 and 8 with insights you get from Winds and Dream of Spring if there is finished. So do you think that HBO would be willing to do that?
Yeah, I think they would. I mean, the show is so huge for them. I think it would get people extremely excited. It would cause, you know, a massive resurgence in like HBO Now subscriptions, and they would have every financial incentive to do it.
People would be going back and, you know, like going back and watching all the seasons to get, you know, the challenge of that, because I think the one thing this show did just superbly is cast.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that you're going to have a real hard time is find a cast that can be these people. You'd have to do like essentially a Joss Whedon. Wasn't it Joss Whedon, or was it the other guy that did Star Trek, the reboot? It was
Abrams.
J.J. Abrams. Yeah. You'd have to do that level of casting where like people look at Chris Pine and like, God damn.
Yeah.
That's a fucking good young Captain Kirk. You look at
Zachary Quinto. Yeah.
Like, that's a damn fine Spock. Like, you have to nail it like that. And that's I actually think that's harder than just casting impeccable book characters, because then it's like people got their feelings, but they haven't seen flesh and blood. Holy shit, that's Ned Stark. Holy shit, that's Queen Daenerys. Like, you've got to compete with that. It can be done. It's just very, very hard.
I almost think it would be better to go back and do the entire series over. Like, I mean, look at Lord of the Rings, right? It's being rebooted already as an Amazon Prime original.
Is it actually just the Lord of the Rings, the original saga?
I think so, but maybe I'm wrong about that, yeah.
Because I thought it was, like, maybe Silmarillion type of stuff, but...
I don't know. They're calling it the Lord of the Rings, at least from what I've read, which has been very little, admittedly. But, yeah, I almost think it would pay to, like, yeah, recast entirely, go back and remake the entire series, because who's not going to watch it? Like...
You
can watch the old ones, or you can watch the new ones and talk about them with your friends as they come out. Like, that seems the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I've often wondered, like, we could be like, would anyone ever reboot the Harry Potter series? Because almost everyone agrees that that was really well cast, and they're pretty happy with the way it went. And I know there's some purists that like start quibbling with the later books that they didn't have every detail in, and maybe they didn't do justice by Ron's character, etc. But like, it's always risky to redo the whole like. All seasons 1 through 6 of Game of Thrones, because they're so fucking good, to redo it, like, you gotta be at least as good, if not better.
Yeah,
if
just shot for shot.
Exactly, exactly.
But then why not? Why bother at all? Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird question.
Yeah. And I think also, like, there's zero reason to do this unless George finishes the books. Agree or disagree?
Disagree. I think... like I said, the financial incentive would be strong.
Okay.
I think there are many, many people.
A valid creative reason.
Okay, yeah.
That fans would be happy with just for the sake of being, you know.
So I think if you tried to reboot, let's call it a reboot, seasons, you know, 7 and 8, a lot of fans would be cheering, a lot of fans would tune in, and a lot of fans would be angry, I think. Like, the people who are really defensive about this and really love it and think it didn't have any execution problems would probably be like, this doesn't make any sense. Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
But I'm gonna predict right now that the overall tone of the discussion in future years about Game of Thrones is going to be an amazing show that ended extremely poorly. Like, Lost. Like, so many others that... you know, just couldn't make it quite across the finish line.
Yeah.
And so I think once you get far enough out, like 5, 10, you know, 20 years out, the opportunity to reboot these last seasons just grows and grows.
Yeah.
Because people, you know, the people who once were fans get a little bit of time from it. And I'm not saying their opinion will change. I'm just saying they might be up for like, oh, let's check out how they do this remake.
I mean, I would.
I would definitely watch it. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, just out of morbid curiosity, like I'd be in for a Harry Potter reboot. Like, I mean, we always have a category in the Baldies or annual kind of fake award show where it's like highest risk, highest reward.
Yeah.
And like rebooting Game of Thrones, rebooting Harry Potter. Anytime you go back and or like if they're really rebooting Lord of the Rings is crazy high risk because
if that's what they're doing. Yeah, I agree.
The extended versions of Lord of the Rings are. Damn near perfect editions. In fact, a lot of times when you, like the hardcore Tolkien fans start talking about like, oh, we should put back Tom Bombadillo back in, I'm like, I don't know about that. Like, I actually think it was smart to pair off as much of the transition from the childhood the Hobbit series to the very dark, mature Lord of the Rings. I just think that's addition by subtraction for the type of thing they're going for. So, like, going and doing that is, like, you're off the charts brave.
Maybe they're foolish. Not doing it. Maybe it's... Yeah.
When is that? Is that, like, this year?
I don't know.
It's not as much on my radar as it needs to be, I think. I feel like as soon as I'm done with this podcast, I need to go and read everything I can find out about this project. Okay.
It's one of the most expensive, or the most expensive television series ever produced.
Garrett B. Danny is very aware that Tyrion freed his brother. Danny is very aware that that Tyrion freed his brother prior to the battle at King's Landing. The guards saw Tyrion walk in, and certainly someone checked the tent after his departure. There was at least half a day between the freeing of Jaime to the initiation of battle. Jaime getting freed at night. The battle happening during the day is the only reference to the passage of time. Yeah, but here's the thing. The previous scene established that Danny won the fight as soon as possible, and at first light was thrown out there. So it's entirely possible that Tyrion broke Jaime out in the dead of night, and only an hour or so elapsed.
Yeah.
I do think that it's not like people are going to forget that this happened. It's going to get back to Danny that she freed Jaime, or that Tyrion.
Sure.
It's going to get back to Danny that Tyrion freed Jaime.
I just don't know. if it has at right. that point.
And there's some people building headcanon in that about that's why Danny snapped, and like that's and until they establish yeah, that you, that's not persuasive, I don't think.
No, you're free to do that. Like if sure. that fills those gaps for you in the story, like go ahead and do that, but don't act as if this is proof and everyone should believe it and just take it at face value.
But I will say that it's entirely reasonable to assume that Danny's going to find out about Tyrion and maybe even Davos's play in the treachery, even though yeah. this is why I thought that's so dangerous for Davos to do. But we'll see. He continues, you said to yourself in a previous episode, a little more wrongdoing and I can see Danny losing it. I think her decision was unearned and out of line, but maybe this is a little extra push that was not explicitly shown to us. Well, if that's the case, it's a failure because it needed yeah. to be explicitly shown to us.
That's the thing. That's what I've been saying. Like, they didn't show me the thing that would push right. Danny over the edge and in that moment. And
yeah,
like, you got to show it to me or I can't just infer something that isn't explained, that isn't
yeah.
on the screen.
And we're not saying like, beat us over the head with it. Like, it's right. like, I love the way they handled Varys poisoning Danny.
Yeah.
Like, you it's can super easily breeze over that, and it feels like something, it's so subtle that he's discussing it openly and you could miss it.
Yeah.
I love that. And I think there's ways you could hint to that, but like for example, right before the battle is joined, Danny kind of imperiously looks at Tyrion and it's like, we'll see how well your brother does when he returns with, or we'll see what your brother does when he returns to Cersei. Like, letting him know that she knows, and they don't have to spell it out to the audience how we know. Like, you can make those inferences like, oh, well, obviously the Unsullied told their boss, and their boss yeah. told Grey Worm, and Grey Worm told Danny, and then Danny probably made lies. But you need something, because mm-hmm. otherwise, how do we know that, you know, Jaime wasn't busted out at 5 o'clock in the morning and the sun rose at 5:15 and the Battle of King's Landing began at 5:30, except for, I guess, the sun was too far up in the sky. Never mind. I'm sure a fan has calculated yeah. angle of the sun, and it was...
that fan is not me. I don't know.
Because it wasn't high noon. She didn't come straight out of the sky. It was...
Yeah.
Wasn't first light, though.
Like 10 a.m.
Maybe you're talking me into it, Garrett.
And she's been circling for a while, looking for a good,
oh yeah,
good time.
She's been waiting
like
for the sun
hours.
To be right in Euron's eyes. Yeah, I need the sun. I need you to diagram a sundial for me, Garrett. I need you to figure out how many degrees high the sun was, and then I can get back. I can get on board with your surmisal here. Okay, Leon T. I have seen and heard commentary that suggests the term Mad Queen is sexist and that the audience is judging Danny by different standards to male leaders and rulers. But isn't the term Mad Queen about how in this universe Targaryens are perceived? Isn't Danny being called Mad Queen a reference to the Mad King? Mm-hmm. Other female characters have done heinous stuff without being universally labeled as mad, Cersei being the most obvious example. Oh, no. Oh, plenty of people, and myself included, have called Cersei crazy and psychopathic.
Yeah.
And I think that's an accurate description of her.
Sure.
I'm not sure the term Mad Queen means that males and females are being judged differently. I just think that this is how characters justify their actions to each other and themselves. And this universal perception of Targaryens is key to how laws and customs are defined in other parts of the kingdoms. It's one of the reasons that Dany's always going to have an uphill battle winning the hearts and minds. The common folk would be suspicious, not because she's a woman, but because she's a Targaryen. This is especially true in the North, where the lie about Rhaegar and Lyanna was accepted as gospel.
I don't understand anything about any kind of sexist angle on this. The Mad Queen is simply a reference to her father, who mm-hmm. was titled the Mad King mm-hmm. because of the lineage. Like... And the potential to commit the same atrocities that he was trying to commit. So mm-hmm. I don't understand. I genuinely don't even understand where that's coming from.
Fortunately, we have the next email that's got a female perspective on it.
Okay.
Anna B says, I've been grappling why Dany snapped and what she did and decided to burn innocent people when she had won the battle. I realize that she ended up being in the same situation that her father was in, and she ended up doing what her father would have done had he not been killed by Jaime. This is an explanation I found on King Aerys through the Game of Thrones wiki online. While Aerys initially appeared to be generous and wise, he later became spiteful of the power of others, especially that of his hand, Tywin Lannister, who had once been one of his closest friends. Eventually grew paranoid of his own family members and a small council. Commonly remembered as a Mad King, his reign became increasingly erratic and murderous. King Aerys was betrayed by his former friend and hand, Lord Tywin Lannister, who led an army under the false pretense of defending the capital at King's Landing. When Aerys opened the gates under Grand Maester Pycelle's council, Tywin proceeded to brutally sack the city. Eris ordered Jaime to bring him Tywin's head before ordering Pyromancer Rossart to initiate the wildfire plan. In response, Jaime killed the Pyromancer before stabbing Eris in the back and cutting his throat. Okay, so there's the background. Dany had been betrayed several times in the past, but she's always had people around who are loved and supported her. However, in Westeros, she has known nothing but betrayal and starts seeing betrayers all around her like her father. Even though she decided to help Jon with her dragons and armies to fight the dead and experience great loss doing so, she feels she isn't appreciated or loved in Westeros because Jon committed his betrayal. Thus, she is right in the same position of her father was before he died, except that she was winning the battle before she decided to burn them all, which is an important distinction.
Huge.
Yeah. I don't think the only one either. I think that when she's looking over King's Landing as the bells are ringing, she knows that even if she does let the city surrender and take the throne then and there, she will never fully have the love of the people because the message about Jon is spreading. And as long as people know the truth about Jon, she will have betrayers all around her life trying to get Jon on the throne and overthrow her. So that's, she decides to, like her father, burn them all because she'd rather people fear her when love is impossible. So actually I think I might have goofed up the emails here, but let's take it for granted that there are women out there who see Dany turning to like the Mad Queen. Not necessarily she went evil, but she's characterized as mad as kind of insulting or a slap in the face. I think that if I'm trying to square the circle, because there's a lot of dudes that wrote in that said that like the idea that Dany being a Mad Queen is being sexist is ridiculous. That this is what equality looks like, that if you accept that women are equal to men, then they should be equally as crazy and murderous and bloodthirsty, and all that stuff is true. To a certain point. And I'm going to see if I can find a middle ground here. I think if I look at society, you know, we're kind of in female empowered kind of heroes terms and entertainment, we're kind of like, do you remember Anchorman, Jim?
Not very well.
Yeah, it's the character Veronica Corningstone.
Sure.
And she was portrayed as being at least twice as good as an anchor person as Ron Burgundy and the rest of the news crew.
That's underselling it, but yes.
But they saw her, the fact that she would be a part, like considered equal to them, as ridiculous. And when they eventually lost and she was made their war against her and she was made a co-anchor, they didn't be like, hey, well fought fight, lady, welcome to the team. No, they continued to try to rat fuck her at every single opportunity and take advantage of her and trick her and do things that they would never do to another man, even one as stupid as like Brick Tamlin, you know, the guy who literally can't think. Mm-hmm. Right. I think that like we're at the stage now where there is a lot more strong female roles. You know, you had a scene in the latest Avengers where, I'm going to try not to spoil it, but like every woman in the Marvel Cinematic Universe kind of stood up together and kicked some ass. And 5 years ago that happened, the internet would be inflamed with dudes being like, oh, how much of fucking forced feminism bullshit. Like, you didn't even really see any of that in even the shittier parts of the internet. Like, people are kind of like, eh, okay, that's fair. So it's getting there. But I think there's enough women that, like, has there ever been a female hero like this to get 72 hours of screen development and then turns out to be a crazy bitch in the end? And I think that does feel a little unfair. It feels a little bit like Veronica Corningstone muscling to the top and elbowing her way to the table with the other dudes, and they continue to kind of, like, you know, try to shit on her.
I mean, I get it. Like, it. Look, I'm sure it does not feel good when you identify so strongly with someone you assume is a hero, and they turn out to be a villain.
Yeah.
But I never read this as Dany is evil because she's a woman, or like her being a woman didn't have anything to do with it. Her Targaryen-ness had everything to do with
right.
it. Like, I'm not going to, you know, take away from people who feel hurt by this turn.
Right.
Because
it is how people feel, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a subjective thing, and it's, I think, understandable. You've invested a lot in this person or this character, and they've let you down. But I always contextualized it not in Dany is a female, but Dany is a Targaryen.
Yeah, and I just say, like, I don't think that anyone saying that is, like, a bad faith actor. I just say, like, I think I understand why women, and another illustration of this is, like, I remember like 10 or 15 years ago when like women became more of a voice on the internet and in gaming, right? That there's a lot of like high-minded guys, like when people, like when women were complaining about, like, why aren't there any female heroes? Why aren't there any people of color in these video games? Why is every fucking protagonist the same stubbly faced, glowering
Nathan
white
Drake,
dude?
Yeah.
Like why is, and like a lot of these guys would come with this PS like, well, it's actually super sexist and racist for you not to be able to identify with the white protagonist. Why does it have to look like you? Flash forward 15 years later, we're like, oh my God, why is this trans person in this game? How am I supposed to identify with this? Why? Oh, you're forcing a black person. There's a woman in World War II. What is this bull? So it's like, there's, you know, like people have irrational feelings when the shit, the way they think that, and I don't think the women,
this is not irrational. Certainly.
I don't think it's irrational. It's like women are like, we thought we were getting this and we kind of got topsy turvied, and it comes on a week where one of the states in America just like fucking outlawed abortion, period.
Uh-huh.
And it's starting to feel like it's sliding into like Handmaid's Tale territory. So like there's valid reasons for women to kind of feel like the carpet was pulled out from underneath them. And I think, you know, we shouldn't like be dismissive, and it's fine to say like factually, hey, I think they were going, but for the Mad King analogy. And the other thing is like the Double D's haven't exactly been exactly perfect in how they treat these situations, because they're older dudes that don't really think about these things any more than your average dude does until they're forced to. So
I mean, the most offensive thing I think that happened as far as this female hero goes is the way the story was told, because in my mind they just completely shortcutted and botched this entire thing, and that's a huge letdown. Like you could almost see a turn where, you know, Dany goes mad and burns King's Landing if it was told better, and you might have understood it a little bit more, but it's just kind of double slap in the face when it's also poorly told.
Yeah.
It's like, not just we're taking your hero away, but we're doing it in this shortcutted, we don't give a shit kind of way.
Yeah. If it was mad, like, and I think also if it was Mad Queen in the sense of her just being angry, like, you know, like in a wounded kind of traumatized kind of way. But it does feel like the most likely explanation for why she snapped is that it is kind of a certain sort of madness that, like, King Air, you know, that just this.
The Targaryen.
Like she just went fire and blood for no fucking good reason, even though every part and you know, we'll talk about this later on because there's a lot to unpack here. But like, I think that's the other thing that stings too, because, you know, the crazy vindictive bitch has been like a slur thrown against women for ever since men decided that they didn't like women getting uppity and demanding equal rights and equality in society.
Yeah,
so.
And it's just such a shame because when the story is told this way, it makes it seem more like that's true, right? Like, oh, well, the dots don't connect, and therefore she's irrational, right? And she's doing this thing because she's a crazy bitch. Like, that shouldn't have even come into the minds of people watching this story. But when it's told so poorly, it has to. Like, or it doesn't. It doesn't have to. But in the people who are prone to that kind of thinking, it will. Yeah.
Or if you actually were trying to paint Dany as a hysterical, and you're like, hey, you know what? Equality is 2019. I'm perfectly fine telling a story where the female gets subverted and she's just fucking crazy and hysterical. Then take it on the chin, because like. Yeah. I mean, I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know if it's 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 40 years or 50 years. Eventually, if things continue to go and we don't slide into fucking New Gilead, Handmaid's Tale territory, there will come a day where, like, you know, if the government's 50% women and men, and the boardrooms are 50% women and men, and like everyone feels like
they're
well represented,
the
then you can do whatever you want with men and women in roles, and no one can ever say like, well, this is unfair, because everyone's got a voice and everyone's had their chance to have their tales told. I just think that we're like, it's almost like, it's almost somewhat revolutionary vanguard to proceed with a story where, well, we can just make a woman crazy because it's 2019.
Yeah, and now's not the time.
Yeah, you guys had Captain Marvel. So, like, it's time for us to remind that you guys can be crazy. And
you got one DC superhero and one Marvel superhero.
Yeah.
No. Now is not the time for that shit.
Yeah. So, anyway, I just want to have... there'll be more discussions to come. Let's see. Oh, Fidel A. I wanted to point out that your disappointment with the main issue of the last episode, Dany becoming the Mad Queen, may stem from a radical difference in moral systems. It's very clear that you're disappointed because you felt Dany's behavior is incoherent with Dany's history throughout the series. During the last podcast, you made it very clear that every time Dany killed someone, she was absolutely justified to do so. You guys even compared Dany's victims to Nazis. I mean, the way that was phrased almost seems like that's an unfair comparison. But, like, burning the slavers in Astapor, like, they're literally using people that they view as subhuman mm-hmm. for profit and treating them as slaves. Like, that is Nazi. I mean, that's, like, you know, like, yeah. maybe even... Yeah, whatever.
Wouldn't make that comparison with Tarlys, but...
Right, sure. Yeah. Tarlys aren't Nazis. They're like, Randall seems like a fucking asshole, but he's not...
Just picked the wrong side.
Yeah. It's very unusual in the U.S. to believe that killing someone may be just... Wait, I'm sorry. It's very usual in the United States to believe that killing someone may be justified even as punishment for past actions. Thus, the existence of death penalty in your country. Obviously, Fidel is not from America. But you justified the crucifixion of some masters, of the masters of Marine based on the moral principle prevalent in countries with Judeo-Christian foundations of an eye for an eye. There are many moral systems where killing is never justified, neither for punishment, which is obvious for 75% of the countries of the world that do not have the death penalty, nor for any other reason. Some moral systems do not even justify killing for self-defense. If you judge Dany from any of these moral systems, and I do, Dany has always been a sadist and a murderer. Therefore, there's no incoherence, business as usual in the destruction of King's Landing. Maybe, and admittedly this is a big maybe, Gurm or the Double Ds wanted to show how flawed a moral system that justified killing is, and that the difference between killing as a punishment or just killing for no good reason may be just having a bad day. What do you think about this, Jim?
I think that's weird in context of Ned Stark.
Mm-hmm.
Ned Stark was never shown to be anything less than a truly honorable man, and he dispensed justice in the form of death.
Yeah.
So if that is truly their intention with the Double Ds or George Martin, they have failed.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah. No, I mean, so that's the thing. Like, if they're really trying to do that and they're bucking a trend, because yeah, I'm anti death penalty. But I'm not a total pacifist. I actually feel that any moral framework that cannot defend itself under any circumstances, like if there's a moral framework that says killing is justified and we're going to kill all pacifists, and the pacifists say, well, whatever you do, we're not going to defend ourselves, like regardless of what is the absolute, like unless you're appealing to like a higher authority like God, well, you know, you can do whatever you want on earth, but there's a heaven and hell, and you're going to hell and I'm going to heaven. If you appeal to that, fine. That's a moral framework that works. But to an atheist like myself, if you're not willing to defend your life against a person that would deprive it, then I don't know what to do with that moral framework. That seems like if you won't defend yourself from the extinction of people that won't respect your moral framework, then what validity does it have? And I feel like there's a lot more people that identify with that than not. So, like, if that's the point they're making, again, just like if you want to make it the fucking Daenerys is crazy, do it and take it on the chin, but don't act surprised that, like, oh my God, I rustled everyone's jimmies because mm-hmm. any violence whatsoever, even against slaveholders, is unjustified. I just don't agree with that. So, yeah, you've correctly identified my moral conundrum, I guess, here. Vanilla pudding. I want to talk about Brienne. What they did with her and Jaime was inexcusable. I was all for this ship. She was told her whole life that she was ugly and undesirable, that she wasn't feminine enough to be loved. Their relationship was unconventional and briefly showed us that this was wrong. You can be strong. You don't have to conform to the gender stereotypes and standards of beauty that society forces upon you to be happy or to find someone who will love you for who you are. The strongest, most honorable, badass woman was just thrown away as a one-night stand, spelled K. N-I-G-H-T.
Nice.
I like that. Very nice. Yep. So he could ignore his whole character arc and go back to his sister because he's hateful and he never cared about the innocent. When he sacrificed his honor and killed his king for them, Brienne of Tarth is reduced to a woman standing outside in her pajamas, weeping over a man leaving her, and I just cannot abide this decision. I don't have, like, you're coming to the wrong shop if you want a defense of that, because I totally agree.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, that's just fucking straight up brutal to treat Brienne like that. And it's exceptionally cruel for Jaime to do so. Because goddamn, what was he thinking?
I mean, I can only go on the line that he delivers there, which is, I'm hateful.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, I have no problem doing this to you.
So I know a lot of people, because I had to take about, like, it's kind of weird for me that Brienne and Jamie had the drink to get, like, themselves worked up to, like, having a consensual sexual relationship. And a lot of people, there's some people that wrote in this week and last that said, you know, Brienne's just a straight up virgin. Jamie, as far as we know, and I think it's made explicit in the books, has never been with another woman other than Cersei. He's never dated. He's never approached a woman. He's been in love with this woman all her life. So, like, these are both very inexperienced people in relationships and very scared and nervous. So maybe it would make sense to kind of lubricate that situation so they're not so freaking out. I don't think they were so drunk that, you know, obviously there's no consent involved, but another way you could look at that is that Jamie knew he was doing something vile to a fairly innocent person and was very deeply conflicted and knew what he was doing was wrong, and kind of like the way Tyrion gets himself drunk when he's going to do something cruel or ugly or unpleasant. And it's a valid way to look at it, but again, I just don't like it. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. And they did my girl dirty, Vanilla, and I'm with you on that. Haley B., we all know and agree how they've screwed up Dany's character arc, so let's stop talking about that and instead talk about how well they did Arya's. Hear, hear. Miss Stark to the core was introduced to us as a small child who loves adventure and loves her family even more. All right, minus Sansa. As a result of her seeing her beloved father die, she starts on an adventure to return to her family, only to hit dead end after dead end. By the point she and the Hound find out about her aunt at the Gates of the Vale, she's already hardening to the thought that she is now alone in the world with her family gone. Then she turns into a faceless man. As we all know, she struggles to abandon her identity during this process, ultimately leading her to leave the many-faced god and return to her roots. She's rewarded with the sight of Bran, Sansa, and Jon. And though she is not the same person she was the last time she was at Winterfell, her experiences have strengthened her love for the Starks. She can now use her faceless skills to protect them, which she does a la the Night King. Yeah, she saved the entire realm by killing them, but quite literally, she kills him to save her brother, Bran. Skip to her conversation with Sandor, where he tells her that she still has time to not be him. One of the many subtexts here is that she still has a chance to have a family. My one last hope for the final episode is this. Let Arya complete her journey from small child that loves but takes for granted her family, to a medium teen lost with no family, to a medium large teen with assassin skills, to a full grown adult with the ability to finally protect her family, something she couldn't do previously. I know she will probably be disappointed. I will probably be disappointed, and she will die trying to kill Dany, but please let her die killing Dany to at least keep her from Dracarysing Jon. Please don't give her a stupid death, and for love of the many-faced god, do not let her live if her entire family dies. They've done a beautiful job of telling her story. I don't want them to fuck it up. What do you think of this take, Jim?
I think it's pretty fair. I like it.
As you guys know, I was pretty anti what they did with Arya, because I thought this was another them curiously veering, like pulling up her arc before it should, you know, fly right into the side of a mountain, no pun intended. But this email kind of turned it around for me, because you're right. The difference between the Hound and her is that she still has these connections to humanity left.
Mm-hmm.
And she's young enough that she can cultivate those just as much as she's cultivated her death prayers and her meditations on vengeance. And it might not be too late. I honestly got to thank you, Haley, because I feel like this kind of has made me okay with Arya's arc in this last episode. And now that I'm reinvested, I'm kind of afraid too. But it does seem like the one way for them to be faithful to this is to have, if she's going to die and she's going to die killing Dany, have it be an act of defense rather than just purely vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, well, let's move on to the next one.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Jill W., I am wondering if anyone has given any thought to Arya's seemingly miraculous escape from King's Landing being engineered by the Lord of Light. If she was, in fact, the reason Melisandre was in Westeros and the reason Barrett continued to be resurrected, perhaps all the scene cuts during her escape was to allude to her being brought back again and again, and so could also explain the very implausible presence of that white horse, especially the blast with Dragonfire. Everyone else around her was burnt Pompeii style, but Arya was virtually unscathed. Not sure how they explained this with only one episode left, though.
Yeah.
I do think there is something interesting. We mentioned this on that interview we talked about on the WCPO, the local Cincinnati television station interview we did yesterday that we mentioned in the show notes, but or the housekeeping. But there is this idea that Davos talked about, like, after the Battle of Winterfell, when he's like, man, the Lord of the Light, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. Looks like he was doing this and doing that, and now he's gone. I don't even know what to think. And they told this very particular story of, like, Beric Dondarrion finished his service to the Lord of Light and died. Melisandre finished her service to the Lord of Light, died. There's one kind of these fire whites left, and it's Jon, or maybe Arya too. What if Jon's purpose is to, quote-unquote, bring balance to the Force by the last of the ice killing the last of the fire, and then they both die, or he kills Dany, and then he just dies because the Lord of the Light's done with him? Mm-hmm. I think there's... I don't know. What do you think of that theory?
I mean, aside from the idea that, you know, once you're done, you just collapse to a heap, I don't really like that idea because we've never seen it.
But you think they could tell it? That story, like, if, like, his wounds started reopening and he started bleeding
Like, Melisandre didn't do that.
But she turned into an old woman.
Beric didn't do that. Yeah, but she voluntarily did it. Like, it's not like, oh, well, her story is complete. Crumple.
Yeah.
You're right. Neither was Beric. He went out sword swinging. Like,
if they wanted to tell that story, the ruby should have failed her, and then she takes it off rather than her taking it off, and then the ruby fails.
Yeah, so. So I don't think that part of it is likely, but yeah, I do think it's difficult to kind of come back around and say, hey, this Lord of the Light thing is what is preserving Arya in these scenes, because I didn't get any of that from the way they told it. But it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, and like, it's one of those things where with the right kind of previously ons and the right kind of flashback and the right kind of...
Yeah.
Honestly, Bran, if he just comes out and says...
Yeah.
What you need to realize is that, you know, like, he can put it all in context of the fabric of time. I think that could be cool. I also think it's not a very fan bankruptcy thing to do, to be pulling for this kind of resolution. But
for sure, yeah.
But what are you going to do? We love the show. Caitlin T. I've seen a lot of complaints about Cersei's death as someone who hasn't, and as someone who hasn't cashed in and declared fan bankruptcy, I want to defend why I thought it was perfect. The thing that was that has defined Cersei, other than being a mother, is her entitlement. As a Lannister and queen mother, she's always been overconfident and arrogant. In the books, it's clear that she admires her father Tywin and thinks of herself as very clever. While in the book version of Cersei isn't as cunning as the show version, the Cersei we've seen on screen has been ruthless. When Ned threatened her about the truth of her children, she didn't cry or plead with him. She made her moves that kept herself and her family safe. When she was supposed to go on a trial at the Sept of Baelor, she instead burned the place down with her enemies inside. After Daenerys attacks, Qyburn has to explain to Cersei piece by piece why each level of the defense that she has is failing. She's finally in tears, understanding her situation. She tries to escape, watching her Queensguard be slain by the Hound, Qyburn shoved aside to die, and the Mountain abandoned her despite her commands to stay by her side. Everything's literally crumbling around her. Before Jaime arrives, she isn't looking for a way to surrender. She isn't trying to riddle out a conversation with Daenerys. She's looking to get out. She goes with Jaime looking for escape. She tells him she doesn't want to die, and then she is crushed. She told Sansa at the Battle of Blackwater that if Stannis men won, they wouldn't be safe as women. Many of them would be raped and impregnated by the morning. While it's unclear how the battle went down, she's prepared to kill Tommen and herself rather than be handed over to Stannis. When Cersei dies this episode, she denies them the satisfaction of having her executed. To me, this was completely in character for her.
That subscribes or ascribes some kind of intentionality to her
death. Some agency and, that I don't think she had.
Yeah, I don't agree that she made a choice there. I think she got pinned in a corner.
She was lost
and accidentally got into a scenario she couldn't get out of.
But on the other hand, like, I think maybe you could say that she's doing her best to escape. She just didn't know how.
Yeah, she is.
She was afraid. I don't know. I guess I resist any. I don't think there's any need to humanize Cersei. Like,
I think at that point it's impossible,
and she's cruel at the for others at the expense of herself. And it's true that she had to do that to survive, but a large reason she had to do that to survive is because she has been vain and cruel and entitled ever since she was a little child.
Yeah, it's sort of self-perpetuating.
Go back and start blaming Tywin for the way she was raised, and you can blame the society for making her think that she would never be as good as a man. But, you know, all the forces that twisted her into the monstrous shape she's in, regardless, she is actually a fairly monstrous shape at the end of this series.
I agree. And so, it's that fact that sort of makes me not have any sympathy for her in the end and for that scene to not really resonate with me.
Right. And I'm not saying, like, I guess I said... It's important to humanize people like Cersei because I don't want people to come away thinking that there's no way I could ever act in this way. You know, like, I think like a wise human should always be on guard against their worst impulses and be aware of try to be as aware as their biases and how self-serving we can be as much as possible. And the more power and the more privileges we have, the more we should keep that in mind, unless we want to live long enough to become the villain. So, but, you know, I'm also not going to fucking cry over Cersei. I might have wished that she had a better death, a more epic death, like dying relatively peacefully and instantaneously in the arms of your lover, being comforted doesn't sit well with me, but, you know, that's like Fidel saying I do kind of subscribe to a little of the Judeo-Christian there should be some kind of, like, I feel like justice does require something more than that, but we don't live in a just world, and for damn sure nobody in Game of Thrones does.
Yeah, I think the closest they came to ever humanizing Cersei for me was the shame stuff that she went through with the sparrows. That stuff came pretty damn close to making me feel some kind of sympathy for her.
Yeah. Well, not that, but like the I think the reason you feel for Cersei is because she's not getting justice. Like these High Sparrow is insane too.
Right. Right.
So, and they're all a bunch of fanatics. So it's like, you want Cersei to be brought to justice, but by someone that's sane, not by someone that's even maybe more capricious and insane.
You want that justice to be righteous, not some kind of, you know, more fucked up version of Cersei taking Cersei out.
Right. Yeah. Josh F. The capital punishment example that Aaron gave during the main podcast was kind of ridiculous to me. I have to assume it's a rebuttal to people pointing out that the man she executed in season 5 as evidence that she was teetering on the edge of madness, but that simply does not compare in any way to the man being accused of an actual crime, being given a trial, and being executed regardless of his guilt or innocence. Here's what happened. The Sons of Harpies, the Harpy attacks, killing Sir Barristan and wounding Grey Worm. Dany, in her grief and anger, gathered up Hisdar and a few other Marinese noblemen bros who weren't slavers. Their parents were executed for that. Dany says nothing of the specific crime and simply scares them by talking about her dragons being hungry. Dany then picks one of them out of the lineup and has her dragons burn and eat him alive without saying shit to him or even accusing him of anything. She does this purely as a fear tactic to get the others to talk, not as punishment, execution, and it fails miserably because none of them were guilty. She even gets a crazy, bloodlusty look in her face when she's talking about how they might all be innocent and she should maybe let her dragons decide. How is doing that in any way comparable to innocent people who are being tried for crimes using actual evidence and being wrongfully convicted, being executed as punishment? Well, the problem with analogies is they're never perfect. And if you want to tear them apart to find the one thing that invalidates it, you certainly can. But the way I see the world is, and at least in America, I can't speak of anywhere else in the country, that I've been persuaded that by many, many studies, that there's something between 2 and 4% of people in death row that are innocent. So governors, and there's like half of the states in the union still practice in some form of capital punishment. The governors who could pardon these men are saying that they're fine with 1 out of 20 people that they execute being innocent. I find that to be in opposition of the other frequently stated judicial justice principle in America, which it's better to let 100 guilty men go free than to punish one innocent man. And nevertheless, even though there's this obvious hypocrisy and moral quandary that these governors face, I'd be very surprised for any of them to firebomb a U.S. city because they want to eliminate a gang or something, right? Mm-hmm. So like that, like Dany doing something that is justified in like a very medieval kind of mindset when you've got a terrorist attacking like civilian targets and, you know, running roughshod over the city. Like, I'm not excusing that. I'm just saying that, like, that's essentially the governor that would go ahead and not reprieve a person knowing that 1 out of 20 of those requests is going to be an innocent man. Then not being surprised that they're not going to indiscriminately kill innocent people. Does that make sense? And if it doesn't, I don't know if I can help you, because like that's as clear as I can. The analogy is not perfect. I'm just showing, like, trying to illustrate how I view the world and the conclusions I came from watching this episode. Heather L., I'm curious on your guys' thoughts on the next episode, though. Wait a second. Can I have another take on that? Heather L., I'm curious on your guys' thoughts on the next episode as far as the following point. It feels like it's headed towards Dany dying, but what I haven't heard anyone talk about is Drogon's reaction to this. If and when Dany dies, how will Drogon take that? Is there enough of a bond that he will feel the loss and go on a path of destruction out of grief? Will Jon, as a Targaryen, be able to calm and control him? Will he fly off into the sunset back into the history books? I know this is a minor plot point, but it's been eating at me that I haven't heard anyone else discuss this. That's a great question, because you've got the biggest baby in the world that's very protective of its mother. You got to have a plan to deal with the dragon if you're going to kill the dragon, the mother of dragons.
Yeah, I would think so.
I mean, Jon has some affinity with these dragons too, but
yeah, but if he goes up and stabs Dany, runs her through right in front of Drogon, I doubt that's going to carry the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what method they would have of dealing with Drogon.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah, I don't know either. There's lots of pieces here to work with. Like, you've got Arya, who's a skilled assassin that might be able to. What if they kill Dany and just Arya wears Dany's face permanently, just to be a surrogate mom for Drogon until he's ready to grow up and move out of the house?
Yeah, how many goats do they have? Can we get like a whole bunch of goats and sort of bribe Drogon into?
Yeah,
like maybe we can distract him, like leave some goat crumbs, and he can follow the path out into the wilderness, and then we can kill Dany, and Drogon will come back and be like, "Where is Dany?" And be like, "I don't know, she left."
I do think Drogon's going to die though, because
I would think so.
It's
yeah.
just almost because it's just he's too big of a. Man, the other thing is, I don't know what kind of wrap up, like, what kind of... I've always expected that there'd be at least an entire episode devoted to, like, what Westeros is going to be doing after all of this is done. Like, what kind of trajectory. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen. Or if we get it, it's going to be, like, 5 or 10 minutes at best. But I never thought the dragons would be part of Westeros going forward, because it's just too... You know, whoever has the dragons has all of the de facto power. Yeah. Like, even if there is a, even if there is some kind of constitutional monarchy, even if there's some kind of democracy, the person that has the dragon has all of the power. They can share it, but if someone replaced them and had the dragon now, then you're fucked, because you just can't go against it. Like, it's just too. It's like one person having nuke and no one else have nukes. So I think he's got to die, not just to pave the way for killing Dany. It could possibly be that someone just heroically sacrifices himself to kill Dany, knowing a Drogon's going to kill them. It could be that's why we kept Bronn alive.
And then Drogon just kind of flies off to, like, old Valyria or something. Just like,
yeah, like
goes to live with the Stone Men.
Yeah, yeah. So what did Bronn say to Jaime and Tyrion? Like, you guys aren't allowed to die. You can die. You're not allowed to die by a dragon. You're not allowed to die by sword. Only I'm allowed to kill you. Jaime's dead. Tyrion's not. Is there a scene where Tyrion's like, look, Bronn, you want Highgarden. You got to fucking earn it.
One more thing, Bronn.
Because Dany's not going to give it to you. You have to do. So I could see. I mean, he's already shot Drogon once before.
Also, there is no better offer on the table at this point for Bronn.
Right.
Who's kind of pushed all his chips in the middle with Tyrion and Jaime.
Right. So I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised to see Bronn involved in the disposition of Drogon and Dany, because otherwise, what the fuck? Why bring him into season at all?
Yeah, he'll be back. We'll see Bronn one more time.
Yeah, Mallory W. I know others have probably had the same take, but I'll jump right in. I'm a metalsmith, so I've always been interested in the way Game of Thrones has used jewelry over the course of the series. Like you, I was captivated in the moments leading up to the execution when Varys removed his rings. This is a very deliberate act, and there's a split second of focus where we get a glimpse of his rings twisting around his finger. It looked to me like there were several gemstones missing from their settings. I think this is a clear indication that Varys is trying to poison Dany, as the show has hidden poison in jewelry before, such as Sansa's necklace leading up to the Purple Wedding. There's a long history of poison rings throughout art history. It doesn't look like Varys removed all of his. There's a larger signet ring, for example, that didn't seem like it was placed in the chalice. So I'd guess that there's more in store for these little rings other than 5 seconds of fame on screen. I love that, because I think they did such a great job of subtly telling the story of the poisoning that if that's just another, like, it doesn't, if you don't understand what he's doing, it doesn't affect the story at all. But if you do notice that there's missing gems and like, oh, these are all my poison rings. It seemed like he probably knew he's dead, but he's also, Varys is a guy that plays a percentage. I'm going to burn the evidence. I'm going to get rid of the poison rings, and I'm not going to give Dany any reason to Dracarys me.
Maybe this will be some kind of trial, and I can get
maybe
through it.
Maybe I can talk
it.
Myself out of it. Maybe I can appeal to,
So I had read about this theory yesterday, and I dismissed it out of hand because the evidence was non-evidence. They were simply saying, hey, in the past they've used jewelry as a weapon. Varys takes off his jewelry. Maybe it's a weapon.
Right.
Nobody had ever said, hey, there looks like there are missing gemstones from the settings.
Yeah.
That, to me, is actually pretty interesting.
Yeah. And I think this is like a... This is one of those theories that's kind of like, God damn it, I can't use this theory because in-game spoilers.
Let me continue on that, because then they went on to speculate on no evidence about the missing gemstones, that simply maybe he's taking them off to allow somebody else to find them and use them on Dany later. That is a really hard sell to me, because you're going to have to do some heavy lifting next episode early on to make that work.
I think the previous shot of him taking noticeably taking his rings off, and they've already had this like kind of waif character, bird character.
Right. The little bird would have to go to someone and be like, hey.
He said highest risk, high reward. Like maybe that's echoing in her ears, and she's a northerner who's mad.
Yeah, I mean, now's the time. She could go like to Jon or Tyrion or somebody and say, hey, Varys was actually, you know, planning to try to take out Dany. He's still got his jewelry in this bowl. Let's do it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. She seemed very scared in the moment. The guards were watching her.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. I think they can tell that story. It just has to be done well. And at the moment, my stock in the Double D's is pretty damn low.
Let's move on to Kurt K. The penultimate email. I think there is a case to be made that the story told in The Bells actually outshines The Red Wedding. In The Red Wedding, we were shocked by the subversion of our expectation that characters that we love will live. We are ultimately satisfied and ultimately read on because despite the shock, it made narrative sense and created a compelling story.
Yes.
The Bells, we were shocked by the subversion of our love for certain characters. We are angry because our love for these characters is broken and because we are blind to clear character flaws that made narrative sense, which to me is more shocking, difficult, and impressive than A Red Wedding. Most watchers are still blind to it. Taking Daenerys as an example, her core character flaw is that she relies on violence when she is not loved. She is not able to find paths forward with parties that do not absolutely agree with her on vision. The groups that love her have been acquired through violence and shared hatred. She lacks love in Westeros and is at complete loss for how to move forward with Sansa, who is reasonably different interest. She nicely summarized the worldview she solidified in Essos at the beginning of the episode. Cersei seeks to use compassion as weakness, but we will use it as our strength to free future generations from tyrants, basically justifying any level of violence and assuming it will lead to love. She characterizes a group of people with a reasonably different interest as a chain on betrayers at the beginning of the episode. She recoils at any form of legitimacy that rests on a political process or love for the masses, i.e. when she discussed secession with Tyrion. As an aside, I think Jaime's interest ending makes Euron more tolerable. We needed a foil to oppose that him that exposed his love for Cersei without subverting the good man that he had become. Okay, I don't know what to say about that final part, but I mean, again, I don't know how else to explain this. Is like, I'm really totally fine with what went on with Dany. I just needed one little thing, and it felt to me like there was tons of little things that could have happened, and the Double D's threw those pieces away for shock value, for surprise, and gave those, like, you know, the death of Rhaegal, the death of Missandei. They just threw those away for very little, like, narrative effect. And that's my opinion. And at this point, it's going to be hard for me to be moved off of that, because what you guys keep doing is further justifying the foreshadowing and telling me that this fault in Mad Queen makes narrative sense. And I'm saying, I agree with you.
We both agree with you.
I agree with you.
Yes.
I agree with you.
However, in that moment, nothing made sense.
Right.
The if you wanted to depict something where the foreshadowing led inevitably to this outcome, you have to do something in that moment that is less than total victory.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what she had, total victory.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she didn't have the love of the people yet, but she had opportunities in front of her to earn the love of the people,
yeah,
by sparing those people, by taking out only Cersei, only the absolutely necessary pieces here,
right? And so, like, I think I've been using this Luke Skywalker example wrong. So, like, I've been saying, like, you imagine, like, Luke Skywalker gets to the throne room and joins the Emperor and kills his father.
Mm-hmm.
That's perfectly foreshadowed throughout the Holy Trilogy. Like,
for sure.
That's a perfectly valid way to take Luke. I wouldn't have liked it, and it felt a bit like I would have cried my fucking 8-year-old eyes out, and I'd burnt all my Luke Skywalker underoos and, you know, got rid of his action figures. I don't know what I had done. But, like, I wouldn't be narratively invalid, and I'd be like, okay, it makes sense. Now, imagine that he threw his lightsaber aside, the Emperor shocks the shit out of him, he gets the thing that he wants, which is Vader redeeming himself, and he throws him at the reactor, and as Vader's sitting there slumped over to side, Luke runs his lightsaber through him, throws him in the reactor pit, assumes control of the Death Star, and destroys the Rebel Alliance and rules the galaxy as the dark Jedi that he was always supposed to become.
Sure.
That's fucked. That is super fucked, because there was nothing to justify once Luke went through and got the thing he wanted why he just went evil, except for he went crazy or the dark side or whatever. And I just find that ultimately, if it's mumbo jumbo magical craziness or whatever, it's not as satisfying as a person using their agency to get the goals that they wanted. And I don't know, like, I don't know how better to explain it than that. I needed that one last thing. I needed that You know, like if Vader is rasping and says, glad we took care of the Emperor, now we need to go kill your sister.
Right.
So we can rule the galaxy.
Then you run him through and you take the Death Star and self-destruct it.
But then that still wouldn't justify him, like, turning completely to the Death. It's like, there's got to be something that would, at the pinnacle of victory, push him over to the other side. And if it, you know, again, there's lots of reasons for you people to smooth this over narratively, because it does make so much narrative and thematic sense, and it is a subversion, and we're trained to love subversions in Game of Thrones, and I'm not begrudging you that. I'm just trying to clearly communicate the actual problem I have with the plot, so we're not arguing about the things I don't have a problem with.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Gregory M., if Dragonfire can destroy buildings with little issue, as was shown in episode 805, then why is Harren's Hall still standing? In Fire and Blood, as well as The World of Ice and Fire, it mentions melting the towers, and it shows the melted towers in the second and third seasons of the show. Balerion the Black Dread was the biggest Targaryen dragon, and he did not lay waste to Harren Hall, so how did a much younger and presumably smaller dragon in Drogon do so to the entirety of King's Landing?
It's a very good question, I think.
I think that, like, you could probably figure this out. There's some kind of material science in Westeros. Like, Harren Hall was made out of this, like, black stone material that probably is different than the bricks that King's Landing are made on, which is essentially just... Bricks are just pottery, right?
What's their mortar made of, though? Like...
Wildfire.
Wildfire mortar? Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't... Uh-huh. It didn't make a lot of sense in retrospect, but, you know...
Yeah, but I'm not... Look, that's nitpicking,
right?
I think. And I've certainly engaged in it, and I occasionally enjoy engaging in nitpicking, mm-hmm. as was the subtitle stuff in the last episode, but...
Right.
You know, I actually agree with you. I think that's a weird thing. I think it's weird to portray it like that, mm-hmm. but that's not the thing I'm up in arms about.
Yeah, and I think that, like, it's like there's a couple other things. So the material science angle, like if Drogon breathed fire in a beach and it turned to glass, and he breathed fire in a field of grass and it burnt, you wouldn't be like, whoa, because you intuitively understand that you melt sand melts and grass burns. And I think it's that kind of situation. But the other thing, if you don't want to go with that, is that Balerion the Black Dread breathed canonically black fire.
What?
What
does that mean?
Just like the undead Viserion breathed this hellacious, like, blue glowing radioactive fire. There's other fire dragons that had, like, gold fire and red fire. Like, and these are magical beasts, so it's entirely possible, because black fire is not a thing that actually exists in the real world, that was a special property of Balerion the Black Dread. That his black fire super melts at the atomic level. It's like that that air purification system we were selling a couple weeks ago. It just rips the castle structure apart at the molecular level. Or maybe that's the Drogon's thing, and Balerion had the black fire, which is more of a melty type of fire. I don't know. They're semi-magical, demigod-like beings. It's going to be very hard to explain it from a Bill Nye the Science Guy type of perspective.
Right.
And that is the emails. That is the spoiler edition we had this week. But as everyone knows, we are not done with Game of Thrones. There is yet another episode that has a lot of stakes, because I do think there is a lot of people in the middle. There's a lot of people that are willing to declare fan bankruptcy and try to see if we can get something that's emotionally satisfying, something that maybe makes some prior plots make more sense. High stakes, high risk episode coming up this Sunday, and the only thing I can promise is that we will be on the air shortly after, doing a live podcast on it for club members, and we'll have an instant takeout for everybody else just a little bit later. We'll have the full coverage on Tuesday. We'll have a final spoiler edition where, among other things, Anthony and I are going to try to piece what a potential Winds of Winter, Dream of Spring scenario would look like using the book characters and setting, and just roll that forward with the events that we saw in the last two seasons of Game of Thrones and see if that makes us feel better. And then also we will have at least one wrap-up podcast after all is said and done, where we try to put this together. And then, you know, because eventually this feed is going to turn into prequel Game of Thrones HBO feed.
If you're not currently subscribed, now is probably a really good time to subscribe, because who knows when that thing is going to be out.
Right.
But we will be covering it, and we'll be doing it right here.
And we'll be
feed,
like, if you're a book fan, or if, even if you're not, but you do you like the lore, let me read the 700-page volume 2 Targaryen history and give you the highlights of it.
Yeah.
If Winds of Winter comes out, we'll have a kind of a book club style discussion of it. There'll be lots of activity in the meantime between the prequels coming out.
So what we're trying to say is Dracarys, that like button.
Yeah.
That subscribe button.
Yeah. Hammer that with the hammer of Bobby B. Hit that like and subscribe button and buckle in, because we're not going anywhere. Godsofthrones.com is where you go to buy my book. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com is where you go to send email and feedback. You can also, there's tons of rollicking threads going on in forums, forums.baldmove.com. Again, we'll see you this Sunday night for our instant take. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.